Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Summer Place, a novel by Jennifer Weiner, read by Sutton Foster.
For Bill Sikin, in memory of Francis Fruman Weiner. Are you sure that we are awake? It seems to me that yet we sleep, we dream. William Shakespeare, A Midsummer Night's Dream. Prologue. For 40 years, the house had stood on the edge of the dune, overlooking the waters of Cape Cod Bay. Over time, the dune had eroded, shearing away in gentle showers of sand. Beech plums and bayberry shrubs clung to its sides like the splayed fingers of a clutching hand. Down below, the water in the bay had crept higher each season, paring off slivers of the beach. The dirt path that once led to the house's front door had been widened and covered in crushed oyster shells. Her grounds had been landscaped, lavender and hydrangeas and bright blooming roses added to the pin oaks and crabapple trees. A pool had been dug out of the gentle slope of the meadow, a guest house and garage added on, then more decks, a hot tub, and an outdoor shower with a crescent moon cut into the arch of its door so bathers could look out at the sea. Through all the changes, the coats of paint, the loose boards nailed down for the second and third times, the hinges oiled and the windows replaced, the house had waited, patient and steadfast. The molecules of her walls vibrated with the echoes of every conversation ever held in her rooms. The ceilings and the floors and the dirt below held the resonances of all she had seen. She knew things, good and bad. She'd seen sorrow and happiness, tragedy and joy, and plenty of the mundane, the cheerful low hum generated by families at the beach in the summertime. Thousands of meals had been cooked and eaten in her kitchen, hundreds of hamburgers and hot dogs grilled and served at the picnic table on the top deck. She had witnessed the preparation of fresh clams and lobster, local corn on the cob and sun-warmed tomatoes sweet as sugar and right off the vine. Couples young and old had danced on her floors and embraced in her bedrooms. She'd seen tender kisses and heard blissful sighs and whispered declarations of love. Babies had been conceived beneath her roof, and those same babies had grown up and come back to her with babies of their own. She'd watched a mother bathe her newborn daughter, and many years later had seen that daughter set her own baby in a crib, then walk toward her mother and embrace her, whispering, "Thank you. I had no idea how hard this was going to be." The house had welcomed them all. She'd borne witness to their histories and had held them close in her embrace. In all those years, through all that time, she had only ever been able to watch. All the pain, all the mistakes. No, not that party. No, no more to drink tonight. No, not him. No, not her. No, don't open that door. Don't answer the phone. Do not let that man back in your bed. She had never been able to assert her own will or even make herself known. For years, she'd tried, but she'd never managed to do more than cause a few odd ripples in the hot tub or make the same screen door fall off onto the deck. That damn door, the families muttered as they lifted it back on its tracks. The house never gave up. She kept working at it, patiently, assiduously, trying to find ways to let her people know that she heard them, that she saw them, that she wanted to help. They might take her for granted. They might leave her empty all through the winter, letting mice chew through her insulation to make nests inside her walls. But she cared for them, and always would. And now another summer was approaching, the days getting longer, the air getting warmer, and her mission had never felt more urgent. Changes were coming. She had so many things to tell her people, and she was running out of time to figure out how. Part 1. Ruby Getting Married. Sarah. On a Friday night just after sunset, Sarah Weinberg Danhauser lit a match, bent her head, and said the blessing over the Shabbat candles in the dining room of her brownstone in Park Slope. Dinner was on the table, roast chicken glazed with honey, homemade stuffing with mushrooms and walnuts, fresh baked challah, and a salad with fennel and blood oranges, sprinkled with pomegranate seeds so expensive that Sarah had guiltily shoved the container, with its damning price tag, deep down into the recycling bin, lest her husband see. Eli, said husband, sat at the head of the table, his eyes on his plate. Their sons, Dexter, who was 8, and Miles, almost 7, were on the left side of the table with Eli's brother, Ari, between them. Ari, twice divorced and currently single, his jeans and ratty t-shirt contrasting with the khakis and collared shirts Sarah insisted her sons wear on Shabbat, had become a Friday night regular at the Danhauser's table. Ari was not Sarah's favorite person, with his glinting good looks and sly smile, and the way he'd borrow significant sums of money from his brother once or twice a year. But Eli had asked, and Sarah's mother-in-law had gotten involved. I know he's a grown man and he should be able to feed himself, but he acts like Flamin' Hot Cheetos are a food group, and I'm worried he's going to get rickets. And so, reluctantly, Sarah had extended the invitation. On the other side of the table sat Ruby, Sarah's stepdaughter, and Ruby's pandemic boyfriend, Gabe. Sarah supposed she should just call Gabe a boyfriend, minus the qualifier, but the way his romance with Ruby had been fast-forwarded thanks to COVID meant that, in her mind, Gabe would always have an asterisk next to his name. Gabe and Ruby had been together for just 6 weeks in March of 2020, when NYU shut down and sent everyone home. Ruby had come back to her bedroom in Brooklyn, and after lengthy discussions, Sarah and Eli had agreed to allow Gabe, who was from California, to cohabitate with her. The two had been inseparable that pandemic year, all the way through their virtual graduation, snuggling on the couch, binging Netflix or taking long, rambling walks through the city, holding hands and wearing matching face masks, or starting a container victory garden on the brownstone's roof deck that eventually yielded a bumper crop of lettuce and kale, a handful of wan carrots, and a single seedy watermelon. Next year will be better, Ruby promised, after posting a series of photos of the melon on her Instagram. Ruby and Gabe had stayed together through the summer, into the winter, and after the new year, when the pandemic had finally loosened its grip. They'd gotten vaccinated, gotten jobs, Ruby as assistant stage manager in an independent theater company in Jackson Heights, Gabe as a proofreader, taken several of their favorite plants, and moved out of Brooklyn and into a tiny studio in Queens, where they'd been living for just over a month. Sarah finished the blessing over the wine and the bread. The platters of food had made their first trip around the table. Ari, Sarah noticed, helped himself to the largest chunk of white meat. She'd just finished reminding Dexter to put his napkin on his lap when Ruby, beaming blissfully, took her boyfriend by the hand. Gabe and I have some news, she said. Sarah felt a freezing sensation spread from her heart to her belly. She shot a quick, desperate look down the table in Eli's direction, hoping for a nod, a shared glance, any kind of gesture or expression that would say, I understand how you feel and I agree, or even better, I will shut down this foolishness, don't you worry. But Eli was looking at his plate, completely oblivious as he chewed. Big surprise. Sarah made herself smile. What's that, honey? She asked, even though the icy feeling in her chest told her that she already knew. Gabe and I are getting married, Ruby said. Her expression was exultant. Her pale cheeks were flushed. Beside her, Gabe wore his usual good-natured, affable look. His dark hair was a little unruly, his deep-set eyes seemed sleepy, and his posture was relaxed, almost lazy, as Ruby put her arm around his shoulder, drawing him close. Sarah liked Gabe, but she'd always felt like he was a boy and not a young man, a mature adult, ready to take a wife and presumably start a family. Not that Gabe wasn't a good guy. He was. He was well-mannered and considerate, supremely easygoing. He never got angry. He almost always looked pleased. Or maybe he just looked stoned. Sarah had never been able to tell, and these days, with pot being legal, she couldn't complain about the smell that had sometimes seeped down the stairs from the attic when Ruby and Gabe had been in residence. "It's no different from having a beer," Eli had told her, and Sarah agreed intellectually, but somehow it still felt different, illicit, and wrong. "Way to go," said Ari, extending his hand across the table so Gabe could high-five him. "Up top," he said to Ruby, who grinned and slapped his palm. "Can we be in the wedding?" asked Dexter. Dexter looked like his father, tall and lanky, with curly dark blonde hair, pale, freckly skin that flushed easily, and elbows that always seemed to find the nearest pitcher or water glass. "We can be best men," said Miles. Miles was more compactly built than his brother, with Sarah's heart-shaped face and fine brown hair. If Dexter was an exuberant golden retriever, Miles was a small, neat cat, his movements careful and precise as he maneuvered his silverware and dabbed at his lips with his napkin. "We've got an even better job for you guys," said Ruby. "We're going to get married in July on the Cape. I already asked Safta, and she says it's fine. She knows it's my favorite time of year there." "So soon?" Sarah blurted, then gulped at her wine. Ruby had always been a determined girl. She hated to be thwarted, despised hearing no or let's think it over, or worst of all, slow down. Even a whiff of a hint that her stepmother opposed this match or thought that Ruby at 22 was too young to marry anyone would have Gabe and Ruby at City Hall by the end of the week with a marriage license in hand. And what was worse, Sarah thought, was that Ruby had told Sarah's mother before she told Sarah herself. She felt a clenching toward the back of her throat, a feeling that had become all too familiar during the pandemic, as she choked back what she wanted to say. Sarah had met Ruby 14 years ago, when Ruby was just 8 years old, a skinny, pigtailed girl walking down the hall of the Manhattan Music School, where Sarah was the executive director. She'd noticed Ruby right away. Or rather, she'd noticed Ruby's father, tall, bespectacled, and a little awkward, one of a handful of men in the sea of women, towering over most of the moms and nannies who sat waiting on the benches outside the kids' classrooms as their children shook maracas or thumped at drums. "Miss Sarah, do you have a boyfriend or a girlfriend or a husband or a wife?" Ruby had asked one day after class, staring up at Sarah very seriously. Sarah had been charmed. "Not at the moment," she'd said. And Eli had put his hand on Ruby's shoulder, gently steering her toward the other kid, saying, "I've got it from here." Eli had taken Sarah to dinner that Saturday night and to a Philip Glass concert at the Brooklyn Academy of Music the following week. Eli was more than 10 years her senior, divorced, with full custody of a child, employed as a periodontist. Back when Sarah had made lists of what she wanted in a husband, any of those facts would have been an automatic disqualifier. She'd thought she had wanted a man her age, unencumbered by either children or ex-wives, a painter or a writer or a musician, not a man who did root canals and gum grafts for a living. Definitely not a man who'd failed at marriage and already had the responsibility of a child. But Eli won her over. He wasn't a musician himself. 6 months of recorder, he'd said cheerfully when she'd asked. But when they started dating, he began reading reviews and following classical music blogs. He took her to hear chamber music concerts and piano recitals, where he listened attentively and was unstinting in his admiration for the musicians. "Someone has to be the audience, right?" he'd said. "We can't all be soloists." She'd smiled, a little sadly, because once being a soloist had been her plan. There was a version of her life where the closest a man like Eli could have come to her would be as a member of the audience, where he'd paid for a ticket to hear her play. But Sarah had abandoned that dream long ago. Sarah loved the way Eli had pursued her with a single-minded intensity, the way he noticed what she liked, the way he always thought about her comfort. If they went out and the weather turned cold, he'd wrap her up in his jacket and insist that she wear it home. If he noticed her enjoying a certain wine at dinner, he'd have a bottle sent to her house the next night. He bought her clothes without asking for or guessing at her sizes. Later, she learned that he'd discreetly asked her best friend. He gave her a pair of beautiful gold and amethyst earrings to mark their first month of what he unironically called going steady. The first time he took her to bed, she'd been delighted and a little surprised at how much she liked it. In the real world, Eli was respectful, almost deferential, a feminist who had no problem working with women or treating them as equal. With his clothes off, he was different, self-assured, a little bossy, in a way that Sarah was surprised to find thrilled her. Best of all was his devotion to Ruby. A man who loved his daughter, Sarah had thought, a man who was a good father would be a good husband, too. She'd been right for the most part. Eli had been a wonderful husband, even if Ruby had been a handful early on. Ruby had liked Sarah just fine when she was Miss Sarah at music school, had resented Sarah terribly when things went from being theoretical to actual, and when Sarah went from being a fun companion who showed up on the weekends and took Ruby to get mani-pedis or tea to a full-time live-in partner to Ruby's father, who made sure that Ruby did her homework, cleared her dishes, and finished her chores. It hadn't been easy, but Sarah had persevered, ignoring the resentment and nastiness, enduring the tantrums and the tears. She'd made allowances after Eli told her that Ruby's mother, Annette, had walked out before Ruby's first birthday, and she had done her best not to take it personally when Ruby made rude remarks or hid her house keys or left unflattering drawings of Sarah, her chin extra pointy, her mouth gaping open, presumably mid-yell, lying around where Sarah was sure to find them. She learned not to flinch when Ruby made a point of correcting anyone who got it wrong. "Sarah's not my real mother." It had taken Sarah years of patience, years of ignoring slights large and small, years of extending her hand and having it slapped away, to finally arrive at the moment, right around her 13th birthday, when Ruby had started to soften and began to let her in. It hadn't hurt, Sarah thought, that Annette had no discernible interest in parenting. Annette was an artist with no actual career and no permanent address. She had always focused on herself and her current passions, whatever they were at the moment, learning to throw pottery or to apply henna designs, performing slam poetry in Seattle, or building costumes for an avant-garde theater company in Brazil. Annette loved to tell the less theater literate that the proper terminology was not sewing or creating costumes, but building them. Annette's creative pursuits came first. Her romantic partners came second. Her only child might not have even made the list. And now Ruby was getting married. Maybe if Sarah had been Ruby's birth mother, she'd have been comfortable telling Ruby no, she was too young to be promising her entire life to someone, that her brain was not done baking, that she still had the whole world to see and explore. Her father and her biological mother could have said those things, and Ruby might even have listened. But Sarah, as a stepmother, had to keep quiet, knowing that if she spoke up, she'd only send Ruby running faster in the wrong direction. "We don't want a big wedding," Ruby was saying, with Gabe's hands still clasped in hers. "Just family and our closest friends. There's not a lot of planning that we need to do, so there's really no reason to wait." Daintily, Ruby speared a drumstick from the platter and set it on her plate. "What about your dress?" Sarah managed. "And flowers? You'll need a caterer, and invitations can take weeks, months." Maybe she could convince Ruby that there were actual practical reasons why this plan would never work. When Sarah herself had gotten married, she and her mother had spent 6 months planning the big day. There had been a rehearsal dinner at her parents' house in Truro, then the ceremony on a bluff overlooking the ocean, and finally the reception at a vineyard underneath a tent on a gorgeous night in early September, when the air was still soft and full of the smell of summer rose hips, the bay still warm enough for skinny dipping. Late at night, after their rehearsal dinner, she and Eli had gone down to the beach, taken off their clothes, and run into the water. "I thought it was bad luck to see the bride the night before the wedding," he'd said. "So close your eyes," she'd whispered back, wrapping her legs around his waist and her arms around his shoulders. "We're going to do email invitations," said Ruby, waving one hand in an airy dismissal of Sarah's concerns. "What?" Sarah squawked, wrenched out of her memory of skinny dipping and rudely returned to the tragedy currently in progress. "Better for the environment," said Gabe, making his first contribution to the conversation. "Siobhan said she'd make me a dress as a wedding gift." Siobhan, Sarah knew, was an NYU classmate who'd majored in costume design. "And Safta said she'd help me with the rest of it." Again, Sarah mentally cursed her mother. Again, she wondered why Ruby hadn't told her first, or at least at the same time. She looked down the table at her husband, wordlessly begging him for help. Eli's face was expressionless. He still had his eyes on his plate and his fork in his hand. As Sarah watched, he shoved another wad of stuffing into his mouth and started chewing. "Can we be ring bearers?" asked Miles. "Are dogs invited?" asked Dexter. "I bet we could tie the ring around Lord Farquaad's neck." At the sound of his name, Lord Farquaad, the family's corgi, who'd been sleeping on his bed in the corner of the dining room, lifted his head and peered around. Once he'd determined that no food was on offer, he gave a chuffing sigh, settled his snout back on his paws, and closed his eyes, looking vaguely disgusted at having been woken up for nothing. "You guys can be ushers. How about that?" Ruby offered. The boys had cheered, and Sarah relaxed the tiniest bit. When Sarah had gotten pregnant, she'd worried that the new arrival would further alienate Ruby. But Dexter's arrival had been the event that finally turned them all into a family. Prickly, angry Ruby had loved the baby unreservedly. The first day in the hospital, she'd begged to hold him. As her dad watched, murmuring instructions, Ruby had seated herself carefully in the armchair and tucked the blanket-wrapped bundle against her chest. "Hello, Dexter," she'd said. "I'm your big sister. And when you're old enough, you can come stay with me, and I'll let you do anything you want." Eli had looked a little alarmed at that assertion, but Sarah's eyes had filled with tears. "Maybe this will be all right," she'd thought. She'd greeted Miles with just as much enthusiasm, and all through college, no matter what else she had going on, she'd spent a week or two each summer with her half-brothers at Sarah's mom's place on the Cape, shepherding them through meals and nap times, driving them to swim lessons and Audubon camp, hunting for clams or hermit crabs on the beach, or going for a bike ride in an ice cream cone. "What's an usher do?" asked Miles. "You get to be in charge of where everyone sits. You help people find their seats, and you ask if they're with the bride or the groom. It's a very important job," Gabe said, with one of his easy smiles. Ruby beamed at him. and Gabe reached over to give her ponytail an affectionate tweak. Ruby's cheeks were pink. Her usually sharp expression was almost dreamy. Her eyes sparkled behind her glasses as she leaned her head on Gabe's shoulder. "Have you told your mother?" Sarah asked quietly. Ruby's expression darkened. "We've talked," she said.
"Which meant what, exactly?"
Sarah shot her husband a frantic look, which Eli, still chewing, either didn't see or chose to ignore. What had Annette said when Ruby called her with the news? Why hadn't Sarah's own mom called to warn her? And what was she supposed to do now? Congratulate those two children? Propose a toast? Before she could decide, Dexter asked Gabe, "Did you give her a ring?" Ruby flipped her hand over, curling her fingers into her palm. "We're going to pick one out together." Ruby leaned over and kissed Gabe's cheek. Sarah swallowed hard. She knew Ruby so well. She knew how Ruby dreamed of being a Broadway director, how Ruby would tell everyone her favorite show was Angels in America, but how she secretly loved Phantom of the Opera, how she hated celery and loved capers, and was so ticklish that she had to cut the tags off any item of clothing that touched her skin. She knew that Ruby hated being short and was secretly vain about her curls, and that she'd been delighted when an eye exam revealed that she was nearsighted, because she thought heavy Clark Kent-style glasses would make people take her seriously. Unlike Ruby with her singular focus, Ruby, who'd known since she'd seen her first Broadway show that she wanted to grow up and work in theater, Gabe hadn't settled on a career. While Ruby had earned a BFA in production and design at NYU's Tisch School of the Arts, Gabe had drifted through the general studies program, graduating with a degree in liberal arts, and, as far as Sarah could discern, no idea of what he might use it for. He'd fallen into proofreading, and seemed to like it well enough. But when Eli had asked about his future, Gabe had just shrugged. This concerned Sarah enormously. "Are we worried about this?" she'd asked Eli, right after the pandemic had started, before Gabe and Ruby had arrived. They hadn't met Gabe yet, and had managed to gather only a sparse handful of facts about him. That he'd grown up in California, that he'd graduate with Ruby, with a degree in liberal arts, and that he was still trying to figure out what to do with his life.
"Why would we worry?" Eli said.
Sarah pointed at her husband. "You knew what you wanted to be when you grew up by the time you'd finished college."
"Probably by the time I finished high school," Eli agreed.
Sarah thought the idea of an 18-year-old dreaming of dental implants and root canals was a little weird. She let it go. "I knew what I wanted to be pretty early on, and then decided not to be it," she thought. But even though she hadn't become a concert pianist, she'd found a way to make music her life. She hadn't floundered around for years, trying this, sampling that. Her own mother, as far as Sarah knew, had always loved books and writing, and had always known her career would involve those things, somehow, and her stepdaughter was the same way. Ruby's always known that she wanted to be in theater.
"Since she saw Phantom," Eli said, smiling fondly.
Sarah had heard the story early on of Ruby's first Broadway show, how enraptured she'd been, how she'd stood at the stage door and waited until every single actor had come out. "We were lucky with Ruby, just like your parents were lucky with you." Sarah pressed her lips together, not wanting to dwell on how often she found herself doubting her choices and thinking about the life she hadn't pursued. "I don't understand what Ruby sees in him. Doesn't it worry you at all?"
"Not really." Eli was in the bathroom with the door open. Sarah could see him studying his hairline in the mirror. "It's probably the sex." Sarah chucked a decorative pillow toward the bathroom door. "Thank you for that. Now I'll just sit here imagining," she waved her hands, "that."
"Ruby's 21. Of course she's having sex," said Eli. He tilted left, then right, frowning, and handed Sarah his phone. "Will you take a picture of the top of my head?"
No, down that road lies madness. Eli's hair was starting to thin, but whenever he asked about it, Sarah assured him that everything was fine. His bald spot, she decided, would be her secret. Men are vain about their hair, her mom had told her. Even though it's not as big a deal for them, they don't like getting older any more than we do. Eli reclaimed his phone and gave his wife a look that was equal parts fond and exasperated. I think Gabe sounds like a nice guy. He plugged his phone into the charger on his bedside table, then retrieved the throw pillow, setting it on the love seat. Not everyone has it all figured out before they graduate. But Ruby does, Sarah countered, swinging her legs off the bed, heading to the bathroom to brush her teeth and floss. Life with a periodontist meant you never got to slack on your flossing. Ruby is going full speed ahead. It's called balance, Eli said, a touch smugly. He compliments her. You can't have two type A's getting married. You need one person who's all drive and determination. With a flourish, he'd pointed at himself in his white undershirt and his plaid pajama bottoms. And someone who's laid back and happy to let their partner lead the way, he'd pointed at her. That, he'd concluded, is the key to a happy marriage. Sarah had shaken her head, smiling, and Eli had come to bed, wrapping his arms and legs around her like a vine around a tree. Wife, he'd murmured into her ear, and she'd fallen asleep, warm and content, knowing that she was loved. How glad she would be now for Eli to tease her like that again, to whisper wife in her ear. How grateful she would be for a moment of connection, however brief, during a disagreement. How she wished that she and Eli could keep talking when dinner was over, so that then, gently, she could turn the conversation toward him and what was going on and why he'd shut down on her just as the pandemic had started and her job and the kids' schools had gone virtual and Ruby had come home and Gabe had moved in. The moment, in other words, when she'd needed him more than ever. But before she could start, she knew Eli would make some excuse about work. A Zoom call, a deadline, something he needed to double-check that sounded both vague and urgent. And he'd go padding down the hall, the flip-flops he swore were helping with his plantar fasciitis slapping noisily against the floor. It was ironic. She and her husband had spent the pandemic year working less than 50 feet apart. Eli handled emergencies when they came up, but usually he was home doing telehealth visits and virtually teaching a class at Columbia's dental school. He had an office. Sarah did her Zooms from the vanity in their walk-in closet, where a fancier lady might have sat to do her makeup. She helped the school's 24 teachers, including the Luddites, who'd never so much as sent a text on an iPhone, figure out how to teach lessons online. She brainstormed with the development office about ways to raise money without the draw of in-person performances that doubled as fundraisers. She coordinated an online holiday choir concert. When she wasn't on camera, she worked in bed, with her back against the headboard and her laptop on a pile of pillows in front of her. The boys' school had been on a split schedule, 2 days a week in person, masked and distanced, the rest of the time at home in virtual school. When they were home, each boy was in his own bedroom on the third floor, unless they were taking gym down in the living room, grunting or giggling their way through sit-ups and jumping jacks, while a teacher called encouragement through the screen. Ruby and Gabe had been on the fourth floor for their classes. All that proximity, the way they lived and worked right on top of each other, meant that Sarah had never felt closer to her sons and her stepdaughter. But she'd felt increasingly distant from Eli, and every day it seemed like he was moving a little farther away. You think you know someone, Sarah thought. She looked at her husband now, at the head of the table, cramming dinner into his mouth, clearly not tasting the food she'd spent hours cooking, not looking at her or at his daughter. You think you know someone. Then you're locked in a house together for over a year, and it turns out you never knew him at all. Well, if no one else is going to do it, I'm going to address the elephant in the room, Aria announced with a smug smile. It was so unfair, Sarah thought, that Ari was the taller, more classically good-looking brother. He didn't use reading glasses, he'd never had back trouble, and his hair wasn't thinning at all.
"What elephant?" asked Miles, looking around.
"Is there going to be an elephant at the wedding?" asked Dexter.
"Arjun at my school went to a wedding with an elephant."
Ari ignored them, waggling his eyebrows at Ruby and Gabe. "Anything else you two want to tell us? Is Uncle Ari going to need to get his shotgun?" Gabe's brow furrowed. Then he ducked his head with a shame-faced grin, as Ruby flushed more deeply.
"No, God, no!"
Ari held up his hands, palms out. "Okay, okay, all good, just checking."
"Uncle Ari," said Dexter, looking deeply disapproving, "you don't really have a gun, do you?"
"It's just an expression," Ruby said.
"Well, mazel tov," said Sarah, lifting her wine glass. "To the happy couple."
Her celebratory declaration, even to her own ears, was far too giddy, too hearty, patently fake. She watched as Eli, with his mouth full, raised his own glass, then started to cough. Miles and Dexter raised their plastic cups. Miles did it carefully. Dexter sloshed grape juice on the tablecloth, even though his glass was only half full. Eli managed a strangled "mazel tov" before starting to cough again.
"Dad?"
Ruby asked as Eli hacked, bent over his plate with his face turning red.
"Dad?
He's choking!" yelled Dexter, jumping up and knocking his chair to the ground. Miles got up too. So did Lord Farquaad, who'd sensed either danger or a chance to snag some roast chicken. "I'm fine," Eli wheezed, waving them off. Sarah stood and bumped the edge of the table with her hip, knocking over the wine, sending dark red liquid cascading down over the tablecloth, soaking her legs and dripping onto the carpet, which she'd had steam cleaned the week before. Lord Farquaad grrrred when the decanter bounced past his head. Sarah pictured the dog snapping at her ankle, pictured herself falling, pulling down the tablecloth as she went. She imagined the lit candles rolling onto the carpet. She pictured the curtains, then her beautiful home, then the whole of her beautiful life going up in flames, burning down to nothing. Eli kept coughing, then hiccuped, then reached for his napkin and finally managed to hack up whatever had gotten stuck in his throat. "I'm okay," he said, waving away the glass of water that Gabe had poured. "I'm okay. Don't worry, everything's fine."
"I'm not," thought Sarah, staring at her family, thinking that Ruby and Gabe's engagement was not off to a particularly auspicious start.
Ruby.
When dinner was over, Ruby and Gabe cleared the table. The boys helped them, carefully carrying glasses and dirty forks and knives into the kitchen. Miles stacked the plates neatly. Dexter grabbed whatever he could reach. "Bride's side or groom's?" Ruby overheard Miles asking Dexter, and she smiled, imagining the two of them in button-up shirts and bow ties. Gabe put the food away, portioning it into Tupperware. Ruby washed the dishes that couldn't go into the dishwasher. She felt a strange sensation, an unfamiliar tension in her chest. It eased a little when Gabe settled his hand at the base of her neck, rubbing gently.
"You okay?"
"I'm fine," said Ruby. "That was just a little weird."
"Mmm," said Gabe, pulling her close.
"They're happy for us, right?" She understood his confusion. Gabe hadn't grown up with a father, or in close proximity to a marriage. During their time in Brooklyn, Ruby had seen him watching her dad and stepmother carefully, a little enviously, sometimes struggling to interpret a look or a joke or a gesture.
"Yes," said Ruby. "They're happy."
"Are you sure you're okay?" Gabe asked.
"What?"
"You shivered," said her boyfriend. Ruby promised she was fine, that her dad and her stepmom were fine, that everyone was happy for them. She hugged Gabe, feeling that delicious sensation in her belly, a softening, melting feeling when he whispered, "You're my sweetheart," in her ear. Then he went to get a broom, and Ruby bent back to the dishes, feeling a dozen different things at once, her head a tangle of emotions that she couldn't unpick or even name. Gabriel Andrews was the first boy Ruby had ever loved. He'd also been the last boy she ever thought she'd have a chance with. Ruby knew she wasn't beautiful. She could look cute, at best, and that was only on the days she put a lot of effort into her outfit selection and used at least 3 different products in her hair. Gabe was effortlessly gorgeous, with his slow, relaxed smile and his deep-set dark brown eyes. She'd noticed him the day she began classes at NYU. She'd exited her dorm room on the 24th floor, stepped into the elevator, and been hammering at the button to close the door, even though she understood, rationally, that those buttons didn't do anything but make you feel like you had some control. The doors had finally started to slide shut when an arm shot through the gap between them, and a male voice called out, "Hold up!" The door slid obligingly open. Someone toward the back of the elevator had groaned, and there was Gabe, who'd smiled a genial apology at the other passengers before plugging in his earbuds and spending the rest of the trip swaying to his own private soundtrack. He'd stood right next to Ruby, close enough for her to smell the soap on his skin and to hear faintly the sounds of circa 2000s Britney Spears. Ruby had been entranced. "He's from L.A., Ruby's roommate's friend Amara had told her 3 months later at a party, when Amara had caught Ruby staring at Gabe while he danced. "Is he seeing anyone?" Ruby asked. "I don't know," said Amara, and blinked eyelashes so long that they brushed her cheeks. Oh, how Ruby had coveted those lashes, and Amara's long, long legs. "He's a cutie, right?" Ruby had nodded woodenly, blushing as she watched Gabe make a fluid turn from the girl he'd been dancing with toward the guy who'd been grinding on him from behind. "Is he bi?" she asked. "Bi, or maybe pan, anything and everything," Amara said with a wink. Ruby nodded, feeling like she'd swallowed stones, like her competition for Gabe's attention had just effectively doubled, that her chances had just gone from slim to non-existent, even though she knew it wasn't true. Liking men and women, one of her friends had once explained, didn't mean that a bisexual person would like all men and all women. The question was, could Gabe ever like her? Ruby couldn't stop staring at Gabe as he closed his eyes, lost in the music, rocking his hips against those of the guy who'd embraced him. He looked like a fallen angel, which was a weird thing for a Jewish girl to think, but it was true. With his beautiful face tilted toward the roof and his hands gripping the other guy's hips, he was a picture of corrupted innocence, like he'd been pure and now couldn't wait to be filthy. Ruby felt herself shiver. At that instant, Gabe opened his eyes, looked right at her, and gave her a teasing smile before beckoning for her to join him. Ruby shook her head and managed a wave, a stupid little half-hearted waggle of her hand, before turning away. He was, she decided, like a statue in a museum. Fun to look at, impossible to take home. She and Gabe had moved in and out of one another's orbits through their first 3.5 years of college. She dated one of his freshman year roommates for a few months sophomore year. He'd been in her history of cinema seminar 2 years after that, loping into the lecture hall seconds before the professor started talking, flipping open his laptop with one languid hand and lounging in his chair like it was a velvet-covered chaise and not nubbly preformed plastic. Finally, in the fall of senior year, they'd worked on a production of The Back Eye together. Ruby had been the stage manager, and Gabe, who'd enrolled in an introduction to stagecraft class, had somehow been assigned the role of assistant lighting designer. "Danhauser?" The director, Professor Caldwell had shouted, waving her over. Professor Caldwell was short and round, with a notable wart on his nose. In the course of his acting career, he'd played hobbits, gnomes, and, in a long-running children's TV show, a troll who lived under a bridge. Each year, the seniors invited all of Professor Caldwell's new advisees to a party where, at midnight, they screened a highlight reel of the professor making children answer riddles, offering pithy wisdom to questing heroes and eating second breakfast. Danhauser, this is... He spent a moment groping for Gabe's name, then gave up and just waved toward him. This young gentleman is going to help run the lights. Hey, said Gabe, with a friendly smile. I'm Gabe. He offered Ruby his hand. Hi. Have you ever worked a lighting rig before? I don't even know what a lighting rig is, said Gabe. It's up there, right? He gestured vaguely toward the ceiling. Oh, boy, thought Ruby. I just changed my minor to theater art, so this is kind of a last-minute thing. Gabe shuffled his feet, looking so crestfallen that Ruby felt her crusty, on-task stage manager heart thaw and crack. Don't worry, she told him. I'll show you what to do. They'd worked together for 8 weeks, through rehearsals and tech week and Caldwell's inevitable dress rehearsal day meltdown, where he'd raged and screamed, announcing that this was going to be the worst show, the absolute worst show that he'd ever had the dishonor of being associated with in all his years in the theater. Ruby, who'd seen this performance 3 times previously, had watched with a jaundiced eye, with Gabe cringing beside her. He looks like Rumpelstiltskin when the Miller's daughter gets his name right, Gabe had whispered after Caldwell tossed his script to the floor and stomped on the ground. Ruby bit her lip to keep from laughing and whispered back that Caldwell had actually played Rumpelstiltskin in a direct-to-DVD movie. Through all that time, Gabe had been friendly, maybe a little flirty. He, like Professor Caldwell, referred to her as Danhauser. Sometimes he'd clap her on the back or touch her on the arm, and he always insisted on escorting her home when rehearsals ended after midnight. She learned that he was the only child of a single mother, that he'd never known his dad, and had always wanted to attend college in New York City, where his mother had lived and where, he suspected, he'd been conceived. But he'd offered those courtesies and told her his story while Ruby knew he was hooking up with other people, first with 2 different members of the all-girl Greek chorus, and then with the guy understudying Tiresias. She hadn't let herself hope. At the cast party, she'd contented herself with standing in a dark corner, sipping white wine from a plastic cup, watching Gabe dance, wondering why he hadn't made that his major, as he waved his arms in time to the beat. She'd been chagrined when he'd caught her staring again, then surprised when he took her by the hand. Danhauser, dance with me. It hadn't been a question, and Gabe hadn't waited for an answer. He'd pulled her through the throng of people and began to dance. Ruby did her best to keep up. Close your eyes, Gabe shouted. She did. And then she felt him pulling her closer, felt his fingers in her hair, tucking one of her curls behind her ear. You're so pretty, he'd said, his mouth close to her cheek. And Ruby had been so startled that she'd blurted, What? Loudly enough for all the dancers near them to hear. You, Gabe said, his mouth very close to her ear. I can't stop thinking about you, with your beautiful hair and your cute little stomping boots. Ruby stared down at the Doc Martens she'd started wearing after someone had dropped a prop marble bust on her left foot during a junior year production of The Play That Goes Wrong and broken 2 of her toes. Gabe had backed Ruby into the corner where she'd been hiding. He'd cupped her cheek in his hand, bent down gently looking into her eyes, waiting for her nod. Then he'd kissed her. first softly, then more boldly, licking at her lips until she tipped her head back and then slipping his tongue into her mouth. "He's done this a lot," Ruby told herself. "It doesn't mean anything." She told herself she was an observer, that she wasn't feeling anything but a clinical, almost scientific interest in how Gabe went about seducing someone. She'd never liked kissing all that much, but as Gabe nibbled at her lips and slid his tongue against hers, she had to admit that she was finally getting the point of it. They'd kissed for what felt like hours, first in the corner, then on a couch. Ruby felt hazy, lust-dazed, her body more liquid than solid when finally Gabe had whispered, "Can we go somewhere a little less public?" "Okay," she'd whispered back. "But you have to stop calling me Danhauser. You have to call me Ruby." "Ruby," Gabe said. Then he'd nibbled at her earlobe, making her moan out loud. She'd taken him back to her apartment, and they'd spent their first night together. They hadn't had actual all-the-way sex that time, but the following weekend there was another party at a rooftop bar in Soho, and they'd both had a few drinks. Back in Ruby's bedroom, the kissing had once again been sexy and luxuriously slow. Later, she'd learned that Gabe had eaten an entire edible before the night began, which meant that everything unfolded at a deliciously languorous pace. By the time they were both naked, Ruby had never been more aroused, but the actual intercourse had been disappointing, clumsy, quick, and unremarkable. "You good?" Gabe had whispered at the end. Ruby had nodded, not wanting to confess that she hadn't come anywhere close to an orgasm or wanting to show him what it would take to get her there. Gabe had fallen asleep with his head against her chest, and Ruby had spent a delightful hour running her fingertips over the silky, almost hairless expanse of his chest and his shoulders. Gabe's skin was the brown of hulled walnuts where the sun touched it, warm golden where his clothes covered him up, and what body hair he had was inky black and silky straight, finer than the hair on his head. Ruby, pale and freckled as she was, prone to sunburns and betraying blushes, loved Gabe's skin. She loved that Gabe got her sense of humor, that he admired her ambition, that he thought that she was beautiful, with her curls and what he always called her stomping boots. Even though they'd grown up very differently, she knew they were the same. Ruby had been abandoned by her birth mother. Gabe had never even known his dad. And even though that first loss had made Ruby a planner, a maker of lists who'd pictured her future in elaborate detail, while Gabe's life with a single mother had left him relaxed and easygoing, willing to roll with whatever life dealt him, Ruby knew that they were more alike than they were different. They were broken in the same places. They were both survivors who knew how the world could bruise you. And that shared knowledge meant that they would never hurt each other. Her senior year, Ruby was sharing a one-bedroom apartment with two other girls in a high-rise that overlooked Washington Square Park. Ruby and her roommates had decided to keep the kitchen and the living room as common spaces, to share a communal wardrobe, they were all more or less the same size, and to partition the bedroom into three private cubicles. Ruby had the cubicle on the left, a space she and Gabe had dubbed the sleep box, a narrow, windowless rectangle with barely enough room for a twin-sized bed and a three-drawer IKEA dresser. For the first few months, living there had been an adventure, like crossing the Atlantic in steerage or traversing the country in the sleeper car of a train. Having sex in the sleep box meant that your roommates and their partners all heard your business and would occasionally cheer you on or call out suggestions. Eating ramen or black beans and rice, using her roommate's parents' account to watch premium cable, getting her hair cut by cosmetology students, and going to bars that offered cheap drinks and free food during happy hour, all of it felt fun even romantic. Ruby understood that, unlike Molly, one of her roommates, unlike Gabe, she was cosplaying poverty, experiencing it with a safety net underneath her, which meant she wasn't really experiencing it at all. She was lucky. She was privileged. She didn't have to worry about student loans or, once she'd graduated, about surviving on what she'd be earning as an entry-level stage manager without a union card. Nor did she have to worry when COVID happened and NYU had gone virtual. "Come home," her stepmom had said, her voice tight with fear, right after 2 weeks to slow the spread became 4 weeks to stop the spread, and it was clear to anyone who was paying attention that the spread was neither slowing nor stopping. "I'm fine," Ruby had insisted. Sarah was a hoverer, a worrier, always reminding Ruby to wear sunscreen and her retainers. Ruby was pretty sure Sarah also tracked her on her iPhone. It was annoying, but also obscurely comforting, to have someone who cared. "I don't think it's safe being on the subway or out on the streets," Sarah had said. "You can't catch it from touching things," said Ruby. "They don't know that," Sarah said. "They don't know how it spreads. And what if they stop letting people go in and out of the city? What if you get sick and we can't help you? Or if we get sick and you can't help us?" Ruby had to admit that Sarah had a point. She also knew that the Brooklyn brownstone where she'd lived since she was 8 years old had much to recommend it. An expansive kitchen, a fully stocked refrigerator and pantry, a washer and a dryer and a home theater with a flat-screen TV that got all the premium channels, not to mention the fourth floor that was hers alone. No more schlepping her laundry to the wash and fold 2 blocks away. No more roommates who could hear her and Gabe through paper-thin walls. Brooklyn was tempting, but Ruby wasn't eager to relinquish her independence, nor was she willing to give up her boyfriend. "What about Gabe?" she'd asked, assuming that would be a deal-breaker. But Sarah hadn't even hesitated. "Gabe can come too," she said, "except he can't keep delivering food." "Mama," Ruby said. After Sarah and her dad got married, Ruby and her father had decided that Sarah would be Mama and Annette would be Mom, although for the first few years, Ruby never called Sarah anything at all. She'd also never guessed that when she was 12, Annette would say, "How about you just call me Annette?" And that by then, Sarah would feel like more of a mother than Annette had ever been. "Gabe has to work. He's got loans." "I understand that," said Sarah, whose usually low, melodious voice was getting high and slightly shrill. "But your dad and I don't feel safe with him in and out of people's apartment buildings, being around all those strangers and then coming back home. How do we know that the people he's delivering to aren't sick? Or that the people working in the restaurants aren't?" Ruby opened her mouth to argue, then reconsidered. Put that way, Sarah had a point. "Gabe has to work," she repeated. "I understand that," Sarah said, "but he doesn't have to deliver food. Let me make some calls." Ruby had agreed, and Sarah had gotten the music school where she worked to hire him to digitize their student performance archives. Ruby was almost certain that at least some of Gabe's salary was coming out of Sarah's own paycheck, which made her feel like crying. That Sarah would quietly make that kind of sacrifice and never say a word, so that Gabe could have his pride, and so that Ruby could have Gabe. She had been so excited to make the offer, to give Gabe the townhouse and, by extension, her family, like a peasant laying a gift at a king's feet. He and Ruby had only been exclusive for about 6 weeks by then, and Ruby couldn't wait to spend more time with him, to get to know everything there was to know about him. If COVID fast-forwarded them through months of dating, then God bless COVID, Ruby thought. "Come live with me and be my love," she said, quoting the passionate shepherd to his love, hoping that Gabe would get the reference from the literature class that they'd both taken, even though she suspected she'd paid more attention than he had. Frowning, he'd asked, "Are there sheep involved?" "Definitely," said Ruby. "Also little kids, but we'd have our own bathroom." She'd expected delight, immediate excitement. Instead, Gabe had frowned, his dark eyebrows drawing down. "It sounds amazing, but are you sure it's okay?" "I'm sure," Ruby had said, looking around, letting her face crinkle in distaste. "And you can't stay here." Gabe's apartment was even worse than hers, a 5-bedroom home in Bed-Stuy, shared with 7 roommates who always smelled like weed and feet. "You're positive your dad and your stepmom don't mind?" he'd asked. She'd assured him that they were fine with it. But it seemed Gabe was struggling to believe her. "Are you sure?" he'd asked her over and over while he packed. "Are you sure it's okay?" She'd promised him. She'd helped him carry his bags downstairs, where they waited for the Uber that Sarah had insisted they take. When the car turned the corner onto the block where she'd grown up, Gabe had gone very still. "Geez, it's a mansion," he'd said when they were both out of the car. Ruby felt her face get hot with one of her betraying blushes. "It's not that big," she'd mumbled. "And this neighborhood wasn't so expensive when they bought it." Both of those statements were lies, and Gabe probably knew it. Ruby had told Gabe that her stepmother was a music school administrator and her dad was a periodontist. As they walked up the sidewalk, she could see him trying to figure it out, trying to do the math that would add up to this house in this neighborhood. Ruby decided to explain. "It's my step-grandmother," she said, "Sarah's mom. She was an author, and one of her books was turned into a movie a long time ago. She helped my stepmother buy this place." Sarah's mother, Ronnie Levy, Ruby's SAFTA, had also paid for Ruby's college education, the same way she would take care of tuition for Miles and Dexter, and her cousin Connor, Ruby's uncle's stepson, when Connor was old enough. But Ruby felt shy about mentioning it. Gabe's mother was a nurse now, but she'd worked as a waitress when Gabe had been little. Savings and scholarships had paid for most of Gabe's tuition, but he'd had to take out loans his senior year. No wealthy grandmother had covered his bills or would buy him a brownstone once he had his degree. Ruby unlocked the door and led Gabe inside, through the foyer and the parlor and the living room and the dining room, up the stairs, past her dad and stepmom's bedroom and her dad's office on the second floor, past her brother's rooms on the third floor, all the way to the fourth floor, the playroom and the suite that had been Ruby's when she'd lived at home. Gabe set his duffel bag down. Ruby followed his gaze, trying to see the room the way that it would look to him. The stained oak floors, the bookcases that stretched from floor to ceiling along the north wall, the cushioned, curtained window seat where a kid could curl up with a book or perform a play or a puppet show. She saw Gabe take in her old kid-sized drum kit, the bins of blocks and Legos, the baskets full of stuffed animals, the painted wooden rocking horse, and the 3-story dollhouse that had once been her very favorite thing. He looked at the cubbies full of art supplies, the full-length mirror, the chest full of princess gowns and fairy wings, wooden swords and magic wands, and the little refrigerator stocked with bottles of water and apple juice. "Is this where you sleep?" Gabe's voice was a little faint. "No, that's in here." She showed him the bedroom, the queen-sized bed with its white-painted, wrought-iron frame, and the padded bench, upholstered in apple-green linen, at its foot. "And there's a bathroom over there." Gabe sat on the bed, his expression uncharacteristically serious, his brows drawn together, his lips in a straight line, a little white at the edges. "I don't get it," he finally said. "If you could have just been living here, why were you in that crap apartment?" "Because I don't want to live with my family? Because I'm an independent woman? Gabe just shook his head. He didn't say anything, but Ruby could imagine what he was thinking. You actually pay rent to not live here? Ruby twisted a lock of her hair around her finger. She and Gabe had talked a little about the differences between them, but their conversations had been general, not specific. She didn't know about the neighborhood in Los Angeles where Gabe had grown up, or much about his life before he'd come east for college. She knew that his mother had lived in New York before he was born, and that she and Gabe had lived with her parents in her childhood bedroom for a while when Gabe was little. She knew that Gabe hated cilantro, that he'd been raised nominally Catholic but never went to church, that he was bisexual and could understand but not speak Spanish. Beyond that, Ruby could make guesses based on what she saw, the way Gabe had worn the same pair of black and white checkered Vans for the entire time she'd known him, or how he always bought used textbooks and sold them back to the university bookstore at the end of the semester, or the way that, when he'd packed, his entire wardrobe had fit into the duffel he'd set at the foot of the bed. At college, rich kids and poor kids and all the kids in between wore versions of the same clothes, ate the same meals, attended the same classes, studied from the same textbooks, and typed their papers on the same laptops. There were differences, of course. Some kids' jeans cost $20 and some kids cost $200. Some kids own the newest laptops and some just leased them from the school. But you had to look for them. College didn't erase the differences between how everyone grew up, but it disguised those differences, except, of course, for the kids who went out of their way to drop the names of the places they'd vacationed or brag about getting bottle service at some club, and those kids were easy enough to avoid. Only now that Ruby was home, she had been unflattened, her circumstances brought sharply into focus, so that Gabe could see her life in all its dimension. And what must that look like? What must she look like now? I know how to fix this, Ruby thought. She took Gabe's hand and tugged him toward the bed. A few minutes later, she was on her back, with Gabe's mouth hot against hers, his hands warm at her waist, and her bra and sweatshirt both shoved up around her neck. Ruby hummed happily as she felt his lips against her cheek, then her neck. After the first few times they'd gone to bed together, she and Gabe had learned each other's bodies, figured out each other's rhythms, where and how they liked to be touched. When they made love, it was always satisfying, even if Ruby worried sometimes that it wasn't the kind of explosive, world-shaking sex that would strip their souls bare and forge the kind of eternal, intimate communion that the movies and books, including her softas, had taught her to hope for. Maybe the books and the movies had it wrong, she thought, as Gabe cupped his hands under her bottom and Ruby wrapped her legs around his waist. Maybe even the best sex was more akin to a good meal than a revelation. Maybe she'd bought into a bunch of stupid, paternalistic myths and was being dumb to worry about how, when she came, it was hardly ever during actual intercourse and usually with the help of Gabe's hand or her own. Maybe, stop thinking, Gabe had murmured in her ear. The feel of his breath on her skin made her shiver. Ruby closed her eyes. The scent of her sheets, her stepmother's fabric softener, was all around her. The feel of her down comforter beneath its crisp duvet cover. The slant of the light through the window, the hardwood floor creaking underneath them, all of it was wonderfully familiar. And as she felt Gabe slide inside her, Ruby felt content, her monkey brain ceasing its chatter until everything was quiet and she felt herself finally at peace, at home. Only Gabe could ever make her feel that way. She never wanted to let him go. That was the night that Ruby decided she wanted to marry her sweetheart. And what Ruby wanted, Ruby got. When she'd decided to learn to play the drums, she'd worked on her dad until he'd agreed. and when she'd wanted to do theater, she'd convinced the head of her high school's drama club to let her join when she was just in eighth grade. She'd gotten into her first choice college. She'd gotten both of the internships she wanted once she was there. She knew how to apply herself and work toward the goal of a future together, and it helped, of course, that Gabe wanted it too. He loved living with her, although sometimes Ruby worried that what he loved even more was being with a family in a big, capacious house with two adults who were accomplished cooks and two little boys who idolized him. In the end, it hadn't been hard at all. "We should get married," she'd said, after they'd made love on a night 6 months later. It had been a Friday, Shabbat dinner, a movie in the basement screening room, which was just an extra-large flat-screen TV and an extra-wide couch. Bowls of buttered popcorn and Sarah's seven-layer bars, which were better than any candy. Slipping away when the movie was over, shedding their clothes in the playroom so they were naked by the time they reached the bed. A perfect night, and when Ruby had whispered her plan, "We should get married," Gabe had said, "I'm in." For months, it had been their secret. As soon as they'd found their own place and started their jobs, Ruby had called her Softa, and Gabe had called his mom, and they'd gone back to Brooklyn to give Sarah and Eli and Dexter and Miles the news. When the kitchen was clean and the boys were in bed, Ruby and Gabe said goodbye to Sarah, Eli had already gone up to bed, and took the subway back to Queens. In their new apartment, they'd made love, and then they'd lain awake, legs entwined. Ruby pillowed her cheek on Gabe's chest. "Tell me about your mom." She said it sweetly, as if she hadn't spent months of their relationship asking and cajoling and finally demanding that Gabe tell her something, anything, about his life in California. He knew all about her. How her mom had left when she was a baby. How when she was little, she used to wish that her mother would come back and take Ruby away with her. How she'd been so awful when Sarah had tried so hard. Gabe knew Ruby's whole story, but she knew very little of his. Now that they were engaged, Ruby felt that he'd forfeited the option of silence. "I need to know about your mother." "She's going to be my mother-in-law," Ruby said. The thought gave her an odd twinge. She felt Gabe's body tense. "She's..." He paused and sighed and didn't continue. Ruby held her breath, prepared to wait for as long as she had to until she got some answers. "She's what?" "She's proud," Gabe finally said. "Proud of you?" asked Ruby.
"Proud in general," said Gabe. "And a little prickly about things, and..." Another long pause. "I'm not sure my mom and your stepmom are going to have much in common," he finally said, his voice low.
"That's okay," said Ruby. "They don't have to be besties."
"No," said Gabe, "but..." He rolled onto his side, so he was facing the wall, turning his back to Ruby as he spoke. "Your parents have that beautiful place. My mom and I lived in my grandparents' house until I was in fourth grade, because my mom couldn't afford a place of her own. She'd sleep on the pull-out couch so I could have the bed." Ruby nodded. This was one of the handful of facts Gabe had shared.
"So you think that Sarah..." Ruby groped, sensing what he meant, not quite sure how to say it. "You think she's going to be, like, snotty to your mother? You think that she'll look down on her?"
"I know she won't," Gabe said bleakly. "She'll be nice. She'll be kind, and that," he said, "is going to be worse. Worse than if she acted like my mom wasn't good enough for her. Like, I'm not good enough for you, because my mom will think she's faking, even if she isn't."
"But Sarah doesn't think that," Ruby said to Gabe's back. and she's not just going to pretend to be nice. She loves you. Both of my parents do. And they're both excited to meet your mother. That's not fake.
I know. Gabe's voice was mournful. I know it's not, because I know your parents. But my mom doesn't.
So what can we do? Ruby asked. He finally rolled back toward her and pulled her against him, holding her tight.
We'll just have to give it time. You can be patient, right?
I know you're great at waiting. At that, Ruby smiled because, as Gabe knew, Ruby was famously impatient, or infamously impulsive, depending on who was doing the telling. According to her dad, her very first sentence had been, "Want that one," uttered as she'd pointed, imperiously, to a teddy bear in a toy store window. Ruby had always known what she desired, whether it was a pattern for a new duvet cover, blue polka dots, not pink flowers, or what she wanted for her 7th birthday dinner, sushi and dumplings and a chocolate cake with chocolate frosting, or where she wanted to go to college and what she wanted to study while she was there. She made up her mind and never second-guessed herself or deviated from her decisions. Ruby for sure, her dad used to call her. Once when she was 13 and absolutely settled on the theme and the location of her bat mitzvah party, she'd overheard him talking to Sarah. "Losing your mom the way she did has to be the worst kind of uncertainty," her dad had said. "I think that's why she's got to be so certain about everything else." Sarah had murmured something Ruby couldn't hear, and Eli had laughed and had said, "Right now, all she can see is black and white. When she grows up, she'll start to see shades of gray." If it was true, Ruby thought, it hadn't happened yet. Right was right, wrong was wrong. Her father and Sarah were good, or at least they tried to be, which amounted to the same thing, and her mother was bad, or at least selfish, which, again, was the same. Thinking of Annette made Ruby remember that she hadn't called her yet. For a moment, she imagined telling her mother the news. "I'm in love, I'm getting married, and unlike you, I will never leave." Except that thought gave her an odd pang, too. "But what if I wanted to leave?" she thought, and then immediately made herself stop thinking. Ruby wrapped herself tight around her beloved and kissed his cheek, then his forehead. Her boyfriend, her sweetheart, her husband-to-be! "Don't worry, all right?" Gabe said, pushing a lock of hair off her forehead, twining it around his finger and letting it boing back into place. "My mom will get along fine with your family, and if she doesn't..." He bent close, nuzzling her neck in a way that never failed to make her shiver. "If she doesn't, she'll be all the way in California." "I won't worry," said Ruby. "I promise." She tilted her head up, and he bent down to brush his lips against hers. They both used the bathroom. Gabe dotted prescription acne medication on his cheeks and his chin. Ruby popped in her retainer. Gabe kissed her forehead, then each eyelid, then rolled onto his back and was almost instantly asleep. Ruby lay awake in the dark. In Brooklyn, the attic was always quiet. Now, in their walk-up in Queens with windows that faced the street, her nights were punctuated by laughter, shouting, sometimes the sound of breaking glass. Cars and buses drove by, along with police cars with their sirens wailing. In Brooklyn, it was easy to imagine that she and Gabe lived in a castle, that they were a prince and a princess high in a tower. Their time in Park Slope had felt enchanted, with delicious meals magically appearing, where they had people around when they wanted company and solitude when they wanted to be alone or together, just the two of them. Now that they'd moved out, Ruby wondered if what she was feeling was that enchantment fading, the luster of new love disappearing, evaporating like a dream, revealing the reality of the world. "Maybe I'm homesick," she thought, and told herself that she just needed to get used to the new place, that she and Gabe would make it cozy and soon it would feel like home. She tried to ignore the tiny voice inside of her that was whispering, "This is a bad idea. You're rushing into it. You're too young. This won't work." Tried to ignore the growing certainty that what she was feeling was surprise and disappointment. When she'd called Ronnie, she'd expected her to say, "Ruby, please tell me you're kidding." When she'd told her stepmom and her dad, she'd been waiting for them to laugh, to shake their heads and tell her, "Absolutely not." She'd been counting on one of the grown-ups to put an end to it. "No, Ruby, this isn't going to happen." But they hadn't said that. They had congratulated her. They'd smiled their approval. They'd raised their glasses for toasts. They'd treated her like an adult who could be trusted to make decisions about her own life. Except Ruby wondered, what if she was making a bad decision? What if she couldn't be trusted? And if that was true, what was she supposed to do now? Eli. Elijah Danhauser was a good man. Growing up in Massapequa, with his parents and his brother, he had been a good son and a good brother, hardworking and decent and kind. He'd worked hard at school and treated his elders with deference, his peers with kindness, and his parents with respect. While his brother, Ari, was crashing cars, flunking out of colleges, and getting arrested, Eli drove carefully, studied hard, and graduated with honors. In adulthood, Eli had tried to be as good a husband as he could to his first wife, Annette. He and Annette met in college at Syracuse University at a fraternity party. Annette was petite, with big hazel eyes underneath a wide forehead, wavy brown hair, and a quick, bright smile. They'd fallen in love when they were both juniors and were inseparable for 2 years. After graduation, they'd set out together to see the world. For 8 years, they traveled, working menial jobs for 6 months to save enough money to fund 6 months of adventures. Eli had a strong back and was good with his hands and could always find work doing carpentry or construction. Annette had an ear for languages and, with her cheerful personality, usually ended up bartending or waitressing. Together, they had biked from Canada to Mexico and worked on a ranch in Montana, with Annette helping in the kitchen and Eli repairing miles of fence on the range. They'd spent a summer at a hotel in Iceland and 3 months crewing a billionaire's yacht. They'd followed the Dave Matthews Band on its world tour in the late 1990s, Annette's choice, not Eli's, and spent half a year living in Madrid, where they could visit the Prado every day, Eli's choice, not Annette's. They'd led cycling trips through the Lake District in England and through the wine country of France and up and down the hills of Tuscany. They swam in volcanic lakes in Guatemala and spent 6 weeks in a yurt in Saskatoon. When their 30th birthdays were approaching, Eli wanted to get married, buy a house, start a family. He'd assumed Annette would want the same things by the time she turned 30. He'd been wrong. Annette, it turned out, wanted none of those things. She had no interest in marrying Eli or anyone else, and had even less desire to buy a house and stay in one place. "I can't do it," she'd said tearfully, in the midst of one of their discussions that always seemed to turn into fights. "I'm not exaggerating, at all. If you make me live in a suburb, I'll die." She'd swung her long hair over her shoulder and started to braid it, a thing she did when she was trying to soothe herself, and Eli had promised no suburbs. But couldn't they find a city they both liked? They'd still been talking it over when Annette had gotten pregnant. Eli realized what had happened before she did. In their years together, he'd gotten used to caring for her every month when her period started. No matter where they were, he'd dig her heating pad out from her backpack or under their bed, find an adapter that would let him plug it in, and spend that first night rubbing her back, bringing her Advil and hot tea. When a month came and went without any requests for back rubs or heating pads or painkillers, he'd figured it out. and when he'd found the positive test in the trash, his suspicions and his fears had been confirmed. She was pregnant, and she hadn't planned on telling him. Eli had put aside his anger and tried to convince her that it was a sign. He'd told her that a baby didn't have to change anything. They could keep traveling, only they'd be a trio, not a pair. Maybe, he told her, they could rent an RV and tour the country's national parks. Or they could visit Sweden, like she'd always wanted to do, and try to find her relatives there. They could live on a houseboat, or in a yurt, or sail around the world. He'd begged, and he'd pleaded, and he'd threatened, and he'd even cried, and finally, Annette had agreed. Fine, she had said with a shrug. The same shrug with which she'd eventually assented to Eli's proposal. Pregnancy made some women glow, but it turned Annette exhausted and slow-moving, her skin pallid and pimply, her beautiful long hair hanging greasy and limp. After the briefest of ceremonies at City Hall, so that the baby would be legitimate, and more important, so that Annette could get on Eli's insurance policy, Eli had brought his wife to New York City and the apartment his parents were paying for. He'd enrolled in dental school in New York City. Dental school? Annette had asked, her eyebrows all but disappearing into her bangs. As she started worrying the end of her braid, Eli told her not to worry, that dentistry was akin to learning a trade, that dentists could work anywhere in the world, because everyone's got teeth, right? Annette had nodded, looking disheartened and unconvinced. That night, she'd woken him up just after 3 o'clock in the morning, gripping his shoulder and shaking him out of a sound sleep. "You're going to move me to Long Island," she'd said, and started to cry. Eli swore that he wouldn't. He promised his wife that nothing would change, that her fears would never come true, while of course he was thinking secretly, guiltily, that once the baby came, Annette would welcome the idea of a fenced yard, safe streets, and that, once the baby came, she'd start to see things his way. Eli worked hard at school. At home, he struggled to convince Annette that the future, while not exactly what she had envisioned, would be fine, even better than fine. He would provide, and they would find a way to be happy. Annette planned on looking for work, but first she'd suffered from nonstop nausea, and then she'd started spotting, and her doctor put her on bed rest. Eli's parents were happy to pay his tuition and to help the young couple with rent and utilities and money for groceries. Eli went to classes and study groups while Annette shut the door to their bedroom and lay there, day after day, growing quieter and quieter as her belly got bigger and bigger. Eli would rub her feet and brush her hair and bring her the food she could eat, plain toasted white bread, cups of clear broth and herbal tea. Annette would sip or nibble, sadly answering his questions with one-word answers, braiding and unbraiding her hair, barely meeting his eyes. By that time, people were starting to talk about postpartum depression, but Eli had never heard of duringpartum depression. He also suspected that Annette wasn't really sad, but rather angry. She felt like he'd tricked her, like he'd trapped her. Deep down, Eli was not sure that she was wrong. "A beautiful girl," the doctor said, handing Eli the wrapped bundle after the endless hours of Annette's labor and the eventual C-section that had gotten Ruby out of Annette and into the world. Eli had looked into Ruby's calm blue eyes, had taken in her finely etched brows and her fuzzy halo of brown hair, and had been enraptured, instantly in love. "Look, honey," he'd said, but Annette had barely glanced at the baby. "You hold her," she said to Eli, in a voice that was barely audible. "I need to sleep." Eli had ascribed her indifference to exhaustion. "I've got her," Eli said, cradling the baby close as Annette's eyes slipped shut. "Don't worry, baby," he whispered into Ruby's ear, aware that his life's priorities had been reordered, instantly and eternally. From now on, this tiny, precious scrap of a girl would come first. Eli was besotted with his daughter. He could have spent hours staring into her fathomless dark blue eyes, tracing with one fingertip the lines of her tiny nose, her plump cheeks, her silky soft eyebrows, her pink gums, with her baby teeth waiting to erupt beneath them. Everything about her, each fingernail, each curl of her hair, enchanted him. Everything she did. Her little mewling yawn, the first time she rolled over or successfully grasped her own foot and shouted in triumph, delighted him. Annette did not have the same interest in their baby. She kept Ruby clean and changed and fed, but she had a hard time recovering from the delivery. Even after she'd healed, it was abundantly clear that she wasn't finding any joy in marriage and motherhood. She complained to Eli that she was bored, home alone all day with the baby. When he encouraged her to make friends, she told him that the other mothers, the ones she met in the park or at Little People's Music, were also boring. All they want to talk about is their babies, she said, which made sense because Ruby was all Eli wanted to talk about too. But Annette couldn't tolerate even a few minutes of conversation about whether rice cereal was really the best first food or exactly how early you needed to get on the wait list for the YMCA preschool. So get a job, Eli suggested. Go back to school. And what happens to her? Annette asked, gesturing at the baby. Eli promised he'd find a way to make it work. His mom could take the train in from Long Island, or he'd hire a nanny. He'd do whatever it took to keep his wife happy and his little family together. One Friday afternoon when Ruby was 6 months old, Eli came home from school to find Annette packing her bags. He assumed she was going to her sister's, where she'd retreated once before when she was pregnant and they'd had a terrible fight. Eli was all for it. You'll take a break. You'll get some sleep, and you'll feel better when you come home. I'm not coming back, Annette said. She told him that she wasn't doing him or Ruby any good, that she had never wanted to be a mother or a wife. Eli was astonished. Yes, Annette had talked about leaving, and yes, he'd told her while she was pregnant that if she truly hated motherhood, she could walk away. But he'd never, ever expected that she'd actually be capable of doing it. Ruby, Eli said, how can you do this to Ruby? Annette told him she had tried. She told him she felt exhausted and lost. Each day a plodding repetition through gray, despairing hours. She reminded him that she'd said that this might happen. And even though he'd cried and promised to do whatever she needed, even though he'd begged her to stay, Annette had been resolute. When he'd said that Ruby needed a mother, she'd replied that she was sure he would find her a great one. He'd cried and she'd kissed him and walked out the door, down the hallway to the elevator without once looking back. Eli had watched her go, numb with disbelief. She'll be back, he told himself. No mother could walk away from her child. When Ruby had woken up from her nap, he'd collected her from her crib, changed her and held her against his shoulder. Ruby had just cut her first tooth. Eli caught flashes of it as Ruby shoved first one wet fist, then the other into her mouth, chomping down vigorously. That, he said, is your incisor. You're going to get 8 of those bad boys, 4 on top and 4 on the bottom. Then you'll get your canines. Those are the sharpest teeth in your mouth. Oh, yes, they are, he said, as Ruby swatted at him and burbled laughter. Oh, yes, they are. That night he'd given Ruby a bottle, then a bath, taking care to wash behind her ears, gently sponging the folds of her thighs, the backs of her knees, and between her toes. He'd toweled her off, dressed her in clean pajamas, and brushed her single tooth, telling her that it was never too early to start a good oral hygiene routine. He read Hippos Go Berserk 3 times and soothed her until she'd finally fallen asleep, a warm, boneless weight in his lap, sitting there imagining his wife buying a ticket and boarding a plane to somewhere. He could admit that he'd lied to her, or rather he'd told her what she'd wanted to hear, about travel and adventure and seeing the world. He'd assumed that she wouldn't want it forever. He hadn't listened when she told him that, indeed, she had.
"I never wanted to be a mother," she'd shout, and he'd yell back, "Well, I never wanted to be a periodontist."
But it wasn't true. He had played at being a free spirit, a modern-day hippie, rootless and untethered. And he'd enjoyed that life, knowing that it wasn't permanent, knowing that deep down he'd always wanted conventionality, a life like his own parents had, only, of course, not miserable.
He'd wanted a suburb, a family, a house with a swimming pool, just as Annette had foretold.
Eventually, Annette had surfaced.